All right, so we've been looking at these lessons dealing with the church, focused first on the idea of what is the meaning of the term church. What does it mean? A group, an assembly, in our case, group of Christians. And we can think about that in more than one way. So you've got the idea of the church, meaning in general what? All right, but meaning in a broad term, what would the church consist of? All Christians, living and dead, anywhere in the world. Who knows who all those Christians are? Only God. We don't have a way of knowing that. So you've got this idea of just thinking of all Christians as a unit. That's the church. But you can also think of the church in a more local sense as like a team of Christians that work and worship together. And we're going to talk a little bit more about those here this morning. And you can also think about the church assembly itself. That is also the church. That's a group of Christians, the actual group meeting of the Christians. So, and there's some other things that would be proper definitions or proper applications of the word as well. We emphasized last time that there is no official exclusive name, no title for the church. Church is described in lots of ways, even by synonyms like body and family and house and things like that. But there's not one distinctive title. Because there were not denominations in the New Testament. There was no need for a distinctive title. And if we're going to try to follow the Bible pattern, we think of ourselves not by a title, but by our relationship with Christ. Now, we talked last time then a little bit about the idea of the singular, plural, and the collective, that if you think of a Christian individually, they're a Christian, or maybe a better disciple, or a saint. You know, we talked about some of those other terms. If you think of them as a plurality, you can think of a pile of Christians, a pile of disciples. But if you join them together, at least in your mind, you're thinking of the collectivity, you're thinking of the group, you're thinking of the church. But I want to mention a principle that I think would be helpful. You all know this, but I don't know if we think about this very much. If you were dealing with like a textbook on some subject, and you wanted to know, you're looking at a biology textbook, and you want to know about cell structure. What do you expect there to be in that biology textbook? An index. And that index is probably going to point you to a specific chapter or section that deals with cell structure. Now, there might be some references to cell structure in some other parts of the book, but there's probably some chapter that deals with the cell and some section in that chapter that deals with cell structure. That's not how the Bible's written. The Bible, you can't say, well, if you want to deal with the church, that's chapter such and such, section so and so. It doesn't work that way. In the Bible, think about the New Testament. I mean, the New Testament consists of four books that deal with the life of Jesus. The book of Acts that kind of deals with the progress of the gospel throughout the Roman Empire. And then letters to all these churches and some letters to individuals and things like that. So if I said, now what's the book in the Bible that tells you all about the church? Could you answer that question? There's not a book in the Bible. You don't say, well, this is the book for the church, and this is the book for this subject, and that's the book for that subject. So when we study the Bible, when we study the New Testament, say, we do it differently than you would a biology textbook. Basically, if we want to know about the church, what do we have to do?
Look at examples of the church.
Yeah. Where? All over the Bible, especially all over the New Testament. We're just looking for information. What does the Bible tell about the church? And it may be here or here or here or here. What does it show about the church? You know, what examples, what patterns can we see? And I used a term last time, but I realized this probably wasn't very well understood, that we study the church inductively. What I mean by inductively is like you take in all the evidence, you start mounting the information and trying to understand what the Bible teaches about the church. You do that with any subject. We're just saying the church because that's what we're talking about in this quarter. And think about it this way. If you didn't have the Bible at all, if we knew nothing from the Bible, what would you know about the church? Absolutely nothing. You wouldn't know there was such a thing, right? You know, all we know about that is in the scriptures as far as what God wants for the church, what God's idea of the church is. So really, the whole subject, we just have to start gathering information and trying to understand it and trying to kind of organize it and understand, okay, this is what this is teaching us. That makes it more challenging in some ways, more interesting, more exciting. I can remember, I've talked about this a little bit, but for me growing up, I had several ideas that just weren't biblical about the church. And I remember as a young adult, just taking and deciding, you know, I just need to start looking at what the Bible says. So among other things, I took my concordance and I took all the references to church and I just started cataloging them. What do I learn in this reference? What do I learn in that reference? And I started eventually kind of grouping them. Well, these passages deal with this and these passages deal with that. And sometimes they deal with more than one thing, you know, you put them in more than one category. But it started helping me get a better idea. What if what I understood already was true? What wasn't? And where do I need to go with that? So that's kind of what we have to do when we're studying as well, is not just assume that everything we've already thought or believed is true. We just need to go back and say, okay, let's take the evidence. And so what we started last time that we haven't finished, we're in lesson two, is just looking at characteristics of the local church. And I've given you several passages, you could add a bunch more, just to look at and think about. And so I suggested last time, and these are just a handful of the details we can learn about local churches in the New Testament, but I suggested that it looks to me like there's a definite membership in a church. Now I'm talking about a local church, that there are people in and out, and they have that concept. They talk about people in that church, whereas Diotrephes kicks some people out of, well, it was more or less his church the way he looked at it. That wasn't appropriate, but that's what he did. Churches could grow in number and things like that. In other words, they could add to their membership. I'm not sure if membership is the best term, but the idea is there's people in and out of the group. It's a definitive group, a local church is. Then we looked at the fact there could be many churches in an area. Churches of Galatia, churches of Macedonia. So we're not just automatically, when we use the word church in a local sense, thinking of all Christians in a realm. We're thinking of teams, units of Christians that are teamed up together to work together. And that's what we'd really looked at, I think, last time. So that's kind of my review. Do you have some questions or comments about all that? Terry.
Importance on continuing study on whatever subject you're looking at to get the complete picture. Mm-hmm. It's the same way with this. You've got to do that.
Right. And we keep studying and we keep learning all our lives and just trying to understand what the Bible's teaching and make sure that we've properly, you know, read the passages and we've understood how they apply and what God's desire is, what his pattern is. Other questions, comments? Okay, look at this. Look at Acts 14:27. One thing that I notice about churches is that they met together. That's not a big surprise to us, I don't think, but let me just prove it with a verse or two. Acts 14:27, when they had arrived and gathered the church together, they began to report all things that God had done with them and how he had opened a door of faith to the Gentiles. So here's a case where the church gathered together. Acts 11:26 says basically the same has the same idea as far as gathering together. It says for an entire year they met with the church. That's in the middle of Acts 11, 26. 1 Corinthians 14 talks about when the whole church comes together. So I learned that God intends for local churches to meet together from those passages and several more. Thoughts and comments about that? That's what we probably already knew that. But it's not bad to know that there's actually a Bible reason why we're doing that, not just that we've assumed that. Here's another thing about churches, local churches. They could hear and speak. You know, letters were written to churches. So it assumes that the church can understand the letter. They can regard the letter. Hear what the Spirit says to the churches as in Revelation 2 and 3. If you have a problem with a brother, go and talk to him. Deal with it. Take one or two more if he won't listen. If he won't listen to them, tell it to the church. If he won't listen to the church, let him be as a Gentile and a publican. That's Matthew 18, 15 to 17. So churches can communicate. Look at Acts 14, 23. Acts 14, 23, when they had appointed elders for them in every church. And you've got several other passages that indicate that churches would have elders or shepherds, overseers that would oversee them. They had some kind of overseeing group of people that were called elders. Now, not necessarily at the very beginning, because here in Acts 14, Paul had actually preached the gospel and churches had formed in these cities, and then Paul later went back and appointed the elders. Obviously, there takes some time for the men to develop the abilities to be elders and perhaps to be recognized in that way. But that's something else. Churches sometimes would have messengers. 2 Corinthians 8 talks about these messengers that were taking the money that had been collected from each church to the church in Jerusalem. Each church would select its own messengers to do that. Thoughts and comments. I'm just kind of throwing out some things that I learn about churches by looking at those passages. Jared.
You know, the church isn't made up of two or three from the passage where you've got a problem, sinning against the brother, then you go and talk, and if you don't listen to them, then you take it to the church. So the church isn't several members. At what point does the quantity become the church?
Okay, good question. I'm going to postpone that because we're going to talk about that at the end of this lesson. The kind of how do you distinguish between some Christians and the church? It's a very good question. If I don't get to that by the end of this lesson, holler, but I've got that in my notes, so very good. I've always gotten people I anticipate where I'm going. Other questions or comments? Now, here's another thing about churches. Sometimes, at least, churches collected money together. In 1 Corinthians chapter 16, Paul says, "Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, so do you also. On the first day of every week, each one of you is to put aside and save as he may prosper, so that no collections be made when I come." Now that was one passage of many that talks about Paul organizing this collection for the poor Christians in Jerusalem. And apparently he had told churches in Galatia and from 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 churches in Macedonia and here the church in Corinth to be collecting money together and that they would send to the church in Jerusalem at a particular time. And so churches sometimes at least would collect money together. It's not the only passage that says that. In Acts 2 and Acts 4, there were Christians that would bring their money to the apostles, which evidently were kind of the leaders in that church in Jerusalem, to distribute among the poor Christians. We don't know how the money was collected other than what we know from these passages, but we know that churches sent money to Paul in preaching the gospel, in like Philippians chapter 4 and 2 Corinthians 11. So sometimes at least churches would collect money together. And sometimes they would give it to people who were in need or churches that were in need or Christians that were spreading the gospel. We'll have some more, another lesson about the details regarding churches and money, but that they seem to at least at times be doing something like that. Questions or comments about that? You could probably go on with this list. That's just kind of a list of some of the things that I learn about churches. What I would like for us to do now is move to something that I think will be just helpful to think through. Differences between the universal church and the local church. I'm using those terms just as descriptive terms. The Bible doesn't speak of universal church or local church. But the Bible speaks of this idea of all Christians as the church, and the Bible speaks of these teams of Christians in a particular location as the churches. And so I'm just using the term universal and local to describe that. If you have a better idea as to terms to use, I'd be glad to listen to them. But I think we understand what we mean. The universal church, all the Christians, thought of as a group, and the local church, a team of Christians. So what if we just started listing, what are the differences between the universal and local church? All right, the first one we've already talked about, pretty obvious. How many universal churches are there? One. How many local churches are there? Many. And you see that all over the New Testament. There's one body. There's, upon this rock I'll build my church or churches? Church. But the churches of Christ salute you, the churches of Macedonia, et cetera, et cetera. All right. Who makes up the universal church? We've said this before, but we'll say it again. Who makes up the universal church? Faithful Christians. Well, how do you know if a person's a faithful Christian or not? We don't. God does. So we don't even really know for sure who's a part of the universal church. God does. Yes, Jason. I'm okay with that, although I'm not sure if we should. I don't know to what extent they thought of themselves as being the church in the Old Testament. They assembled together. They had the assembly a lot. So I don't know. I wouldn't argue that point one way or the other. I do think that, really, the church does involve the people of God who are dead. I mean, just dying doesn't make them not a part of God's people. So I would suggest God's people, living or dead. Yeah, Jason.
That's just one example where I think when we use the word church, we narrowly think of just New Testament. And
there's certainly a continuity. I mean, you've got one olive tree, branches broken off and branches grafted in. So yeah, I'm fine with thinking about it that way. I'm not sure if they thought of themselves that way. But what about, yes? Well, are we saying anything different? You know, when we talk about the universal church, we're just talking about God's people, thinking of them as a group. Yeah, I don't know if we're really saying anything different other than just collectivizing them in our mind. Yeah, they're really just God's people. It's not like the church gives some special status over and above being God's people. I think sometimes we may miss that. I mean, people will talk about, well, Jesus loved and died for the church. The church must be such a wonderful thing. Well, but who did Jesus love and die for? When we say he loved and died for the church, he loved what? Us. Yeah. Right.
And gone. So do we typically do we think about it more as a present?
Good point.
Time frame as opposed to all time, which goes to his question, the Old Testament believers that had their sins washed as that blood rolls back. Well, they're Christians, but do we say they're church? typically use that type of language because I think about it more as a present time as opposed to a past.
Although they are still alive to God and they're still presently a part of God's people, yeah. And it might depend on whether we think in universal or local church. I don't know that the local church involves people who are dead, but the universal church really are just God's people in whatever situation. So what about the local church? Who makes up the local church? Some Christians in a particular location that have decided to join themselves together. Now, we'll talk in a moment about whether or not they're all Christians or not. How do you come into the universal church? How would you become a part of the universal church? God adds you. What do you need to do? Yeah. Turn to the gospel, repent and be baptized. Yeah, that kind of thing. Be converted to Christ. How do you become a part of a local church? Yeah, you agree together to work together. You know, Paul was shunned for a while in Jerusalem. They didn't want to accept him. That wasn't necessarily the best thing, but you could see why, based upon their imagination, he was some kind of a double agent. So you come into the universal church by being converted to Christ. You come into a local church by agreeing together with one another to team up together and to work together. It really is a mutual agreement. Now, from that standpoint, who controls the membership of the universal church?
God.
Only God. Yeah, no individual does. You know, we don't decide who's in and who's out of the universal church. Who controls the membership of a local church? Yeah, the church itself, for good or for bad. You know, are there times when a local church might have somebody in it that they shouldn't have? Can you think of an example? Yeah, 1 Corinthians 5 with the man who was living with his father's wife. They were told to deliver him to Satan. He shouldn't have been a part of that church, but they were allowing him to be. Can you think of an example when somebody wouldn't be allowed to be in a local church that ought to be? What about Diotrephes kicking those people out of his church? He's kicking them out of the local church, but he shouldn't have done that. So when men control the fellowship of a local church, they may not do that properly. But local church members are whoever the group decides is a member. And the universal church membership is whoever God knows is a faithful Christian. All right, I've said several of those together because they kind of fit together. Comments and thoughts on those so far? Okay, think about this. How would somebody be removed from the universal church? Who said? They fall away, yeah. And God, you know, distances them from him. God cuts them off from him. God won't do that as long as we're believing in him and faithful to him. He won't cast us out, John 6. But if we leave, he's willing to let us leave. And only God knows the point at which somebody leaves his fellowship. How would somebody be removed from a local church? Properly, what would we do?
You're speaking unfaithful again.
Yes.
Okay. We would need to identify and mark.
Right. You've got passages like 1 Corinthians 5, where when the church is assembled together, they should deliver to Satan someone who was grossly immoral like that man was living with his father's wife and not associate with them. Now, you could have a situation like Diotrephes kicking people out improperly, you know, but still that the proper way to do that would be to discipline an unfaithful Christian. Let me ask you this, a totally different track. When did the universal church begin? Well, maybe if Jason's right, it began in the garden, I don't know. But when did Christ's universal church begin, Jason?
Still difficult. But at the cross, when his blood cleansed all.
Yeah. In Jesus' purview, I mean, You know, I think it's reasonable to think of Acts chapter 2 as starting with the 12 and many people being baptized on that day, but I'm not so concerned about an exact point in time. When does a local church begin? Yeah. When did this church begin? Anybody here then? I don't know. I don't know if we have anybody in this. Yeah, there, Tom. In what year? 96, okay. There's the definitive answer. 96. Now, we would normally identify where the Universal Church began with Jerusalem or that area. Where did this church begin? In Bargersville, right? But in Bargersville?
No, we just got it around Franklin.
Okay, all right. In various places in Johnson County then. Yeah. So there's a we're just setting up to see the concept that the universal church is one thing and the local church is a different kind of a thing we're looking at. In what way does the universal church assemble together? Or never? The assembly, look at Hebrews chapter 12. The assembly of a universal church is more conceptual. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 22, but you've come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to myriads of angels, and to the general assembly and church of the firstborn ones who are enrolled in heaven. Now this general assembly and church of the firstborn ones, is there some physical assembly of the universal church? No, not here on the earth. You know, one of these days there'll be a physical assembly of all the universal church in heaven, but physically the universal church does not meet together here on the earth. The local church, does it have physical assemblies? Well, this is one of them. Okay. Sure.
Because you think about somebody who maybe is concerned that the whole local church isn't assembled together in certain respects. So I would think because we are a living temple, you know, as you just mentioned, yes, one day in heaven. But if we're faithful members of Christ, there is a sense of unity. There's a sense of commonality in that. And maybe I'm splitting hairs, but I would be afraid that somebody would dive down a path of the local church.
Okay, the local church has assemblies. That doesn't necessarily mean every member is present. Are there any kind of universal church assemblies on the earth? I would say no. There's not some kind, I don't know of something in the Bible that indicates the universal church is called to assemble together on the earth. All right, so think about that. When we gather together to partake of the Lord's Supper, in what context is that done in the New Testament? Local church, yeah. I think the local church gathers together to partake of the Lord's Supper. I would suggest in Acts 20, you have that idea. I think you also do in 1 Corinthians 11. But Acts 20... They came to Troas in verse 6, and in verse 7, on the first day of the week when we were gathered together to break bread, Paul began talking to them, intending to leave the next day, and he prolonged his message to midnight and so forth. Seems to me like that was an assembly of the local church there. And as far as I can see in the New Testament, the Lord's Supper is a part of the worship of the local church. It's part of the assembly of the local church. I don't see the idea in the New Testament, somebody may correct me on this, but I don't see the idea of the universal church having a summons to meet together here on the earth. Jason? Right, be hard for them to meet together, right? Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think so we're really seeing the universal church as a different kind of thing than the local church. The universal church is this idea of Christians as a group, but it's not physically meeting group. It's a group in our mind, in the concept, in the idea of thinking of all God's people as one. The local church is much more of a concrete entity. It's a team of Christians. We know who they are. They've agreed together to work and worship together. They have regular worship services and things like that. Does that make sense? Who is the leader of the universal church? God, Jesus. Look at, for example, 1 Peter 5. 1 Peter 5, verse 4. When the chief shepherd appears, who's the chief shepherd? Jesus. Now, who are the leaders of the local church? Jesus is, but you've got shepherds. So you've got, the shepherds in chapter 5 of 1 Peter, and then the chief shepherd. So you have no, would there be any human overseers of a universal church, any human overseers? No. Now, there's a sense in which the apostles obviously had, they represented Jesus and they revealed the message, but as far as human overseers of the church today, as the universal church, I don't think there are. Are there human overseers of local churches? Yes. Thoughts and comments to that point? Any questions, discussions? Yes, Austin.
Even if somebody tried to go down the path of apostles being some kind of ordained leadership, I mean, every one of them describes themselves as a servant of Christ. And so you can sort of squash that attitude.
Yeah, although elders are servants of Christ as well. I wouldn't necessarily argue against the leadership of the apostles. But we have no living apostles. They lead us today through their word. And I don't know that the leadership was quite the same, but I think there is some leadership function of the apostles in the New Testament. I wouldn't necessarily argue against that. So let me ask you this. I've got two more here. What's the collective work, of the universal church? What's the work the universal church does as a group? All right, but they do that individually. What would be the collective function? The way I'm thinking of that, none. The universal church doesn't have a task they meet together or they team up together and do as a team. What the universal church does, they do through all of us individually. But there is collective function for a local church. There are things local churches do together, like worshiping together, meeting together, like things they do as they pool their resources and they do them as a group. So there's collective function for a local church, but I would argue that there's no team function as a team of the universal church. And then the last one. So the universal church is basically a relationship of Christians with who? God. But the local church involves a relationship of Christians with each other. There's a horizontal relationship in the local church. All right, so those are, I just think thinking through that, I'm not trying to make any of that law and gospel, but thinking through that just helps us get more of an idea of what we're saying with the universal church and what we're saying with the local church. Questions and comments on all that? Michael.
Probably has nothing to do with either one, but where does home churches fall in this? Like, there's a local church, and they decide to, some brethren decide to go worship in the home place of
that. Well, I don't think that a local church place of meeting changes anything about the nature of the local church. Local churches can meet in homes, they can meet in buildings, they can meet out in the air, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know that there's any biblical statement as to where a local church must meet, or that that takes it away from being a local church.
So the reason, maybe the reason why they're worshiping away from the local body?
Well, I mean, if a local church meets in a home, they are part of that. They are worshiping a local body. They can meet in a home. They can meet in a building. Now, if somebody's, somebody's saying, oh, I'm not worshiping with a local church, I'm just worshiping in my home, then that might be a different question. But as far as where a church can meet, they can meet wherever. Okay? Anything else? All right, let's look at this question that Jared raised about individual Christians and the local church. Look back at Matthew 18. That's the passage that sprang from. This is challenging for us at first, because we're thinking of a local church as a group of Christians. So look at Matthew 18, 15. If your brother sins, go and show him his fault in private. If he listens to you, you've won your brother. But if he does not listen to you, take one or two more with you, so that at the mouth of two or three witnesses, every fact may be confirmed. If he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. If he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. So first it's you and him. Then it's you and him and one or two more. And then if he doesn't listen to them, then you tell it to the church. So what's the difference between you and him and one or two more and the church? How many people does it take to make up a church? Well, it's not a question of the number of people. How many people would it take to make up a church? Well, church is more than one, you know, so I guess two. When I was in Brazil, Pedro and I started a church, just the two of us initially, because that's all it took is two. And gradually more people joined us and were converted to the Lord or joined us who had already been Christians. So the question isn't the number of people. The question goes back to this idea of singular, plural, and collective. If you've got just one Christian, then you've got the singular. You can have 1,000 Christians and them not be a local church. You know, just usually have a bunch of Christians together. But the collective would be the local group that is has a team. They've agreed to work together as a local church. So it's not the number of people. It's the idea of whether or not we're looking at them individually or whether or not we're looking that at them as a group. Jason. Right. Okay, let him tell it to the church. Listen even to the church. I hadn't thought about it, maybe. Yeah, maybe. Andy.
You know, it brings up an interesting point. When I lived in Bethel, Alaska, there were three people. There was a husband and wife who came together specifically to worship God every Sunday and study the Bible every Wednesday. When I came there, the three of us did that. He led.
Right.
Our assembly. He wasn't an elder. There were only three of us there. Did that quote unquote count?
Why wouldn't it?
Right.
As far as I know, there's no minimum number requirement other than it takes more than one to make a group. But yeah, two people can form a church, a local congregation. Yeah, I would see no problem with that. So there's a difference then in the people between just Christians individually grouped, kind of thrown in together, and the congregation that assembles together, meets together, works together. Look at Acts 5. Acts 5 is where they were giving money to the apostles for the poor Christians. And Ananias and Sapphira sold a piece of property and kept some of the price back, but they represented it as being all of it, and maybe they'd pledged to give all of it. I think that's possible. They brought a portion of it, end of verse 2, laid it to the apostles' feet. Peter said, Ananias, why has Satan filled your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit and to keep back some of the price of the land? While it remained unsold, did it not remain your own? And after it was sold, was it not under your control? Why is it that you've conceived this deed in your heart? You've not lied to men, but to God. We have to think about this one a little bit. You know, you've got this money. So Ananias and Sapphira sold the property. They got the money. And he says, it was your money. Now, your money, in quotes, all of our money is God's, right? We didn't really invent it, you know, we didn't give it to ourselves, but it was still in their control after they'd sold the property. Would we be automatically obligated to give all money from the sale of property in a situation like this? No. That's optional. There was not, as far as I can tell, they were not requiring every Christian to sell everything and give the money here. That was something they were choosing to do. But once they gave the money, who had control of the money? The church, under the leadership of the apostles, yes. And so there's a difference between the money that was still under their control. All of it's God's in one sense, but the money was under their control when they'd sold the property, hadn't given it yet. The money they gave was now under the control of the apostles for the church. So there's a difference between the money in my bank account and the money I give to the church or give to the apostles here, that's under the control of the apostles and the local church. So I'm saying there's a difference between what the individual has and what the church has. I couldn't just say, well, I'm a part of the church, so I'm going to take some of its money. No. There is a difference between what's in my bank account and what's in the church's bank account. Look at one more, 1 Timothy 5, and then if we need to talk about this some more Wednesday night, we can do that. 1 Timothy 5, verse 16. If a woman who is a believer has dependent widows, she must assist them, and the church must not be burdened so that it may assist those who are widows indeed. Who is supposed to take care of a widow if the widow has children and grandchildren? The children and grandchildren. First responsibility is to our own family. Now, what if the widow doesn't have any children or grandchildren? Who's supposed to take care of her? The church. There's a difference between what the individual is supposed to do and what the church is supposed to do. So I'm just suggesting that there's not only a difference between the universal church and the local church, but there's a difference between the local church and the individual Christian. There's a difference in who it is. There's a difference in the money. There's a difference in the work. That the local church is the team, and they have certain responsibilities, and they have the money given to them. And the individual Christian has other responsibilities and the money that's under their control and so forth. Comments or questions on all that? Does that make any sense, Michael?
That would be the same as if, like, there was a disaster somewhere and you want to donate money. You can't just donate money to the local body, all the local churches. You have to do it individually to each congregation, right?
Okay, yeah, you're right. How else would you do it? Yeah, yeah, certainly. Other thoughts? All right, so that's given you some things to think about. I realize that, you know, when we're studying inductively, when we're just trying to look at various passages, it's not as concrete. This lesson probably was less, you know, something you could just say, okay, I get that. But it helps you to think through different concepts in the New Testament. What I'd like for us to do for Wednesday night, this is going to be the only lesson I do like this. Lesson 3 has 3 pages, and I've given you several quotes. Those are going to be hard quotes to read and understand. We'll talk about them a little bit. I'm just trying to use them to illustrate some wrong views people have about the church. And so we'll work on that together. And I think that can be helpful to us in clarifying our own views about the church. So we'll work on lesson 3 on Wednesday night, and I appreciate your comments.